Good evening and welcome to the Sunday Monitor. This is KPFT Houston. Thanks for joining us. This is Mark Rabawi along with Pokey Anderson. Welcome back, Pokey. It's good to have you back again.
It's good to be back.
We have two live interviews for tonight and a feature story from Shannon Young. Our first guest is going to be Melissa Boyle Maley. She is a former CIA field officer. She worked for many years in the CIA's Near East office. We'll be talking to her about the CIA, the September 11th attacks, and U.S. policy in the Middle East. Our second live interview will be with Kurt Eichenwald. He's been reporting for the New York Times for 17 years. He just published a new book this month called Conspiracy of Fools. The book deals with the true crime story that was the Enron scandal. We'll be talking to him, of course, about Enron and his new book. Under the current administration, the federal government has aggressively used a well-established tool of public relations, the pre-packaged, ready-to-serve news report that major corporations have long distributed to TV stations to pitch everything from headache remedies to auto insurance. In all, at least 20 federal agencies, including the Defense Department and the Census Bureau, have made and distributed hundreds of television news segments in the past 4 years, records and interviews show. Many were subsequently broadcast on local stations across the country without any acknowledgement of the government's role in their production. You won't get any of that on this show or in this station. We welcome your comments and questions by email. That address is sundaymonitorjournalist.com. Coming up next is our locally produced, edited, and collected news summary. No federal agency assisted us in bringing this news to you in any shape, way, or form. Our first news headline is about a local guy, at least somewhat local, Tom DeLay. A legal defense fund established by Tom DeLay, the White House majority leader, has dramatically expanded its fundraising effort in recent months, taking in more than $250,000 since the indictment last fall of two of his closest political operatives in Texas, including Mr. DeLay's latest financial disclosure statements. The list of recent donors includes dozens of Mr. DeLay's House Republican colleagues, including two lawmakers who were placed on the House Ethics Committee this year, and several of the nation's largest corporations and their executives. Among the corporate donors to the defense fund is Bacardi USA, the Florida-based rum maker, which has been indicted in the Texas investigation, and Reliant Energy, another local company, which is another major contributor to a Texas political action committee formed by Mr. DeLay that is the focus of the criminal inquiry. Groups seeking an overhaul of congressional ethics rules have long complained that companies might seek the favor of powerful lawmakers by contributing to their defense funds.
Might seek the favor.
Might, yes.
Okay, well, we'll make sure and keep that as a might. This week we noted the celebration of International Women's Day, and women's groups from around the world began a march for equal rights on Tuesday. The global tour for a charter for equal rights gets underway in Sao Paulo, Brazil, and will come to an end in October after passing through more than 50 countries. The Women's Global Charter for Humanity was adopted by women's rights groups in the capital of Rwanda in December. Organizers said that tens of thousands of women attended Tuesday's start of the march. The charter proposes, quote, to build another world where exploitation, oppression, intolerance, and exclusion no longer exist, and where integrity, diversity, and the rights and freedoms of all are respected. The Montreal-based World March of Women, which penned the document, quote, views patriarchy as the system oppressing women and capitalism as the system that enables a minority to exploit the vast majority of women and men. Some of the worst problems experienced by women around the world were highlighted in a new report by the World Organization Against Torture, published to coincide with March 8th, International Women's Day. The report says that, quote, gender plays a major role on the type of torture used, the circumstances in which torture is used, the consequences, and the availability and access to justice. The coalition of non-governmental organizations fighting against arbitrary detention, torture, summary and extrajudicial executions denounced the fact that women continue to be denied legal protection against the flaunting of national and international rights. The World Organization Against Terror, against Torture rather, denounced rape and other violence against women and girls perpetrated in many countries around the world. Women being raped in war was recently made a crime by the International Criminal Court. The UN Food Agency, the World Food Program, said Tuesday it is committed to reducing additional burdens often put on women in developing countries, as children have a better chance of growing up well-nourished when women are in control of food. One geographical area that has escaped attention is the jungles and border towns of the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, where one of the world's great humanitarian crises staggers on. Millions have died or been displaced, reports Nicole Itano of Women's E! News. And tens of thousands of women and girls have been victims of sexual assault there, including at the hands of United Nations peacekeepers. A report released this week by Human Rights Watch says combatants on all sides of the Congo's conflict are guilty of widespread sexual violence and that little has been done. In January, the United Nations released the results of their own investigation and concluded that there was, quote, a pattern of sexual exploitation by peacekeepers. Even peacekeepers accused of sexual misconduct are rarely held accountable, admits the UN. Women are also increasingly in the line of fire from the multi-million-dollar international trade in small arms, according to a report released by Amnesty International and Oxfam. A World Bank report has placed violence against women on a par with cancer as a global cause of incapacity and death among women of reproductive age, calling it a greater cause of ill health than traffic accidents and malaria combined.
In the weeks after the fall of Baghdad in April of 2003, looters systematically dismantled and removed tons of machinery from Saddam Hussein's most important weapons installations, including some with high-precision equipment capable of making parts for nuclear arms. This is according to a senior Iraqi official. The Iraqi official, Sami Al-Araji, the deputy minister of industry, said it appeared that a highly organized operation had pinpointed specific plants in search of valuable equipment, some of which could be used for both military and civilian applications, and the machinery was removed. Dr. Al-Araji said his account was based largely on observations by government employees and officials who either worked at the sites or lived near them. He said, quote, they came with cranes and trucks. They depleted the entire sites. They knew what they were doing. They knew what they wanted. This was sophisticated looting, unquote. The threat posed by these types of facilities was cited by the Bush administration as a reason for invading Iraq, but the installations were left largely unguarded by Allied forces in the chaotic months after the invasion.
Well, there has been a bit of a chant to get over the 2004 election, but in fact, the 2002 election is still being discussed in courtrooms. As reported by the AP and others, the former executive director of the State Republican Party of New Hampshire was sentenced Thursday to 7 months in prison for jamming Democratic telephone lines during the 2002 general election. Chuck McGee pleaded guilty in federal court to conspiring to make anonymous calls to annoy or harass. He was fined and ordered to perform 200 hours of community service. I made a mistake, said McGee. I'm prepared to pay for that mistake. He also said, quote, I'll be back in 2006 to help some good Republicans get elected, unquote. McGee resigned in 2003 after police alerted federal prosecutors to the phone jamming scheme. He denied any wrongdoing at the time. He later admitted paying about $15,000 to a Virginia telemarketing company that hired another business to call get-out-the-vote phone banks and keep their lines busy. More than 800 computer-generated calls lasted for about an hour and a half on election day. U.S. District Judge Joseph DeClerico said, quote, actions of this nature strike at the core of the democratic process. James Tobin, the former Northeast political director of the National Party Committee working to elect Republican senators, is also charged in the case. Prosecutors say he orchestrated the jamming. He has pleaded innocent. The telemarketer, Alan Raymond, who was president of Alexandria, Virginia-based GOP Marketplace at the time, has pled guilty to hiring another firm to make the calls. He was sentenced earlier this year to 5 months in prison. He pleaded guilty to jamming both Democratic lines and the lines of the firefighters group, which helps offer rides to voters. And then in another voting story that we're keeping our eye on in Maryland, we spoke with Linda Shade, who directs a citizens group there called True Vote Maryland. Linda says that according to county election officials and other sources in Maryland, all of the Maryland voting machines have been on lockdown since November 2, 2004 because of statewide machine failures, including 12% of machines in Montgomery County, which is in suburban Washington, D.C. Maryland is an all-electronic, paperless state with voting machines by default. Some of the machines appear to have lost votes in significant numbers. The State Board of Elections in Maryland said that Election Day went smoothly, when in fact there were serious statewide systemic problems. According to Linda Shade, quote, Election day was anything but smooth. Votes were lost. Computer cards storing votes were unreadable. Thousands of error messages were reported. Machines froze in mid-voting, and machines refused to boot up. The problems with the machines were so widespread and serious that efforts to hide the problems have failed. She said it is not sufficient for Diebold and the State Board of Elections to investigate themselves. They have misled the public about this problem, and an independent investigation is needed. Further, these problems indicate that the Diebold machines should be decertified as required by Maryland law and as provided for in the Diebold contract. She continued that, quote, this is an opportunity to correct the mistaken purchase of paperless electronic voting machines. Linda tells me that a whistleblower who appears to be knowledgeable and perhaps an insider is emerging in Maryland, and we will be watching this story.
We'll certainly hope for updates as that develops. In February of 2003, an Egyptian Muslim cleric known as Abu Omar was walking to a Milan mosque for noon prayers. He was grabbed on the sidewalk by two men, sprayed in the face with chemicals, and stuffed into a van. He hasn't been seen since then. Italian investigators, however, now appear to be close to identifying his kidnappers. Last month, officials showed up at Aviano Air Base in northern Italy and demanded records for any American planes that had flown into or out of the joint U.S.-Italian military installation around the time of the abduction. They also asked for logs of vehicles that had entered the base. Italian authorities suspect the Egyptian was the target of a CIA-sponsored operation known as Rendition, in which terrorism suspects are forcibly taken for interrogation to countries where torture is practiced, or at least commonly thought to be practiced. The Italian probe is one of three official investigations that have surfaced in the past year into renditions believed to have taken place in Western Europe. Although the CIA usually carries out the operations with the help or blessing of friendly local intelligence agencies, law enforcement authorities in Italy, Germany, and Sweden are examining whether the U.S. agents may have broken local laws by detaining terrorism suspects on European soil and subjecting them to abuse or maltreatment. The CIA has kept details of rendition cases a closely guarded secret, but it has defended the controversial practice as an effective and legal way to prevent terrorism. Intelligence officials have testified that they have relied on the tactic with greater frequency since the September 11th attacks. The Bush administration has received backing for rendition from governments that have been criticized for their human rights records, including Egypt, Jordan, and Pakistan. Not mentioned on this list in the report by the New York Times is Syria, where some suspects have been taken for interrogation. The administration is getting a much different reception in Europe to this, where lawmakers and prosecutors are questioning whether the practice is a blatant violation of local sovereignty and human rights. There are many practical and legal hurdles to filing criminal charges against U.S. agents, including the question of whether they are protected by diplomatic immunity and the matter of determining their identity. However, prosecutors in Italy and Germany have not ruled out criminal charges. At the same time, the European investigators are producing new revelations about the suspected U.S. involvement in the disappearances of four men, including the Egyptian I mentioned earlier, each of whom claims they were physically abused and later tortured. We may actually get some comment on this from our first guest, who is on hold right now. We're going to take a very quick break. I wanted to tell you that we usually have so many more news stories than we have time to cover. We'd like to mention lots of other news stories, but we always run out of time. If you have a web connection, you may be interested in an article on the Vanity Fair website called The Spoils of War. Go to vanityfair.com and look it up. It's a long but worthwhile read about Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root profits derived from the Iraq War. One of the central figures in that story is on our list of potential future guests, so tune in every Sunday at 6. We're going to take a very short break right now, but we'll be back with our first live interview. Stay tuned for that. We're joined now live by Melissa Boyle Maley. Welcome to the Sunday Monitor.
Well, hello. Thank you for having me on.
Melissa is a former clandestine operative and one of a handful of women in the CIA who spoke Arabic. She was there for several years. I suppose we could say you had a unique vantage point from which to view the political and operational culture of the agency in the post-Cold War climate, and hopefully you'll reveal a little bit about how the CIA failed to anticipate the 9/11 attacks during this interview. Since leaving government in 2002, you've worked in a private consultant on Middle East political and security affairs. Is that a fair summary?
Yes, it is.
And you recently published a new book called Denial and Deception, An Insider's View of the CIA from Iran-Contra to 9/11. I wanted to ask you, first of all, about 9/11. Iran-Contra is a little bit before my time, personally. But how did you draw that time frame, first of all? Why is it significant from Iran-Contra to 9/11, before we look at 9/11 in some detail?
Well, I started with Iran-Contra because it was a seminal event for the CIA, and it really marked a changing point in how the agency looked at its mission and how America looked at, or policymakers looked at, what the CIA should be doing. And so from that period of time, I tracked several themes that would take us up to the 9/11 period in order to answer the question, you know, just how could a 9/11 happen? What was going on?
So can you summarize for us what the CIA mission was viewed as before Iran-Contra and how it may have changed since? So why is Iran-Contra so significant?
Well, with Iran-Contra, the fallout of it, actually, the CIA began a process which made it very risk-averse, and it stopped doing a number of the activities that it had done previously. We got out of the covert war business. We dismantled our paramilitary operations. We also changed our target set so that we just collected on a few issues rather than being a global service collecting on pretty much anything and everything that might be of interest to U.S. policymakers. And as a consequence of all of that, we missed the developing storm to a great extent of the rise of this very virulent form of Islamic extremism that Osama bin Laden preaches. And we're blind to developments in Europe, so that when the bombers, the hijackers on the 9/11 planes, we didn't know who they were. We knew Osama bin Laden, we knew about al-Qaeda, but we didn't understand the scope of really what was coming at us.
Now, you said that the storm was missed to a large extent. There are those who would argue that al-Qaeda-type bases and operations in Afghanistan in the early days were received CIA backing and training and funding to some extent. How is it? Is this some kind of miscommunication inside the government?
Well, no, that's not true. The CIA never funded, or the U.S. government never funded, al-Qaeda training bases. That's a reference to the period during the Afghan-Soviet War.
Right, in the late 70s and I guess up into the early 80s.
Right, but that's, the CIA never funded the foreign training effort that was going on in Afghanistan. We had plenty of people that we were working with, the Mujahideen, the Afghanis themselves.
Mm-hmm. So before al-Qaeda was known as such, there were a couple of fairly key U.S., Middle Eastern allies, including Egypt, which were pretty involved with, I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, maybe the training and sort of increasing operational possibilities behind several fairly extremist Muslim groups, including the Muslim Brotherhood, which were fairly commonly known as being behind the assassination of an Egyptian president in 81. Was information not being shared then between the Egyptians and the Americans on this? Or how did you view that? What do you think of that?
To the contrary, the U.S. and Egypt were very much focused upon the Egyptian extremist groups, and we were focused in Sudan in particular in the early 1990s. And so what we didn't see, as we were looking at the Egyptian Islamic Jihad and al-Jamia al-Islamiyah, we were not seeing what was going on outside of that scope. In particular, when we first noticed Osama bin Laden really in Sudan, he seemed like a minor bit player, maybe a financer, but we did not understand, and we significantly underestimated the role that he was playing in Africa at that time on an operational level. And because our focus was on Sudan and Egyptian Islamic extremism, when bin Laden relocated to Afghanistan, we underestimated what the activities that he was taking on in the global jihad, so to speak.
So some of the statements that I've heard from some insiders in the CIA and the NSA about target selection for the beginning of the Afghan war, when a direct quote, and I can't name the source on the air, about what the target list should be, included phrases like, we knew what the targets were because we built them. You would disagree with that assessment?
Oh, I disagree with that totally, yes. No, we knew what the targets were because we had been watching the Afghan camps quite carefully from 1996 and on. But that was exactly the problem. We had been watching them.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't been acting against them, and there's a big difference. And one of the things I argue in my book is that because of the risk aversion that grew up after Iran-Contra, and for a number of reasons, other reasons, we did not undertake aggressive operations against in the war on terrorism, specifically against those Afghani-based camps, We had gotten out of the paramilitary business, and we were not even thinking in those terms. But if we had taken down those camps by 1998, just think about it, or even 1997, all of the hijackers trained in those camps in 1998 or later, if they had been removed, we would have removed that very key organizational base.
Well, this brings me to, I suppose, the wider question of context and motivation. You start your book, not the very beginning, but pretty early on in the introduction, you have a page which I'm just looking at right now. It's at the beginning of part one, you quote President Bush on September 12th, where he says that the deliberate and deadly attacks which were carried out yesterday against our country were more than acts of terror, they were acts of war. This will require our country to unite in a steadfast determination and resolve. Freedom and democracy are under attack. Do you view it in those terms? I mean, I assume you do, since you used that quote at the beginning of the first part of your book.
I mean, I won't say, is freedom and democracy under attack? I wouldn't say it is. I mean, those is a nice way for the president to put it. But I mean, this is a defensive jihad against the West. It's a skewed interpretation of Islam, but nonetheless heartfelt by Osama bin Laden, al-Qaeda members, and their greater supporters. And I think in many ways this is an existential threat against the U.S. Because it goes to the core of many of our beliefs. That doesn't mean we have to engage in this clash of civilizations. We just need to recognize the context in which these events are taking place.
So when you say it's an attack against core beliefs, what exactly do you mean by that? Because there are people in the Middle East who will argue that as extremist as bin Laden and his group are, they draw a lot of fundamental support. Maybe I shouldn't use the word fundamental. They draw a lot of widespread support from non-extremists because of the quarrels that they cite with the U.S. And a lot of people support the idea, not so much the methods, but the idea of opposing U.S. hegemony in the region because of what they see as double standards and things like that. Do you think that people in the Middle East are maybe hungry for freedom as opposed to wanting to attack it?
No, I think that they are hungry for freedom. I'm of the belief that in many ways the U.S. has gotten caught up in the crossfire of somebody else's war, that Osama bin Laden is striving to recreate or to forge a different kind of reality in the Islamic world, in his world. And he sees us as an obstacle. He sees the United States, the West, as an obstacle to doing that. But it's fundamentally an issue, a domestic issue for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he is addressing legitimate gripes within, particularly the Arab world, and that's why he has he's able to garner such support for his message.
Do you think that those gripes are viewed as legitimate by this and previous administrations?
Definitely not.
Can you list them just for those who might not be familiar with them?
From the perspective, if you read the writings of bin Laden, he talks about the subjugation of the Muslim people, the stealing of their land and their resources, the killing of Muslim children in Iraq, for example. He details a whole long list of crimes that the West has committed against the Muslim people. And the way he frames the issues are in a way that it touches this deep sense of injustice of how the particularly the Arab states have been left behind, that they have been subjected to a regime that's a very repressive domestic regimes that have been supported by the U.S. And a lot of that is very true. But in the U.S. context, we tend not to give these complaints very much credence, and you see that by the official approach to bin Laden that he's a criminal, he's a terrorist. We don't want to grant him the position as an ideological leader, in other words, of a message that has some credibility to it.
So I guess what this brings me to is, you were saying that if we, meaning the West or the U.S., had been successful in dismantling the camps in Afghanistan in the mid-90s, that maybe September 11th wouldn't have happened. And that may be true, but I guess my point is, without addressing the concerns, are you only putting off an attack? I mean, aren't there eventually people going to take action, in more direct action, and attempt to attack the United States when these beliefs and these gripes that you say are legitimate are so widely held?
Well, I think there's, you know, you have to parse the issue a little bit more exactly.
Mm-hmm.
If we had taken down the camps earlier and before Osama bin Laden had the chance to mobilize global support by bringing in from around the world, from the Islamic communities, people and training, indoctrinating them and training them in the weapons of war and terror, and then actually letting them use these skills on the battlefield and then sending them back to their communities. If we had done that before, then we wouldn't be dealing with a global insurgency at this point in time.
What do you think we would be dealing with?
Well, I think that we would be dealing with, once again, the isolated but nonetheless credible complaints within particularly the Arab world about how their governments are treating them.
So do you see these as two sides of the same story? And if so, how would the American government go about changing and addressing the situation there for the majority of the people?
I think that the U.S. is just finally now putting together a strategy to deal with the underlying issues that are feeding the discontent and the anti-Americanism. I wouldn't say that we have a global strategy yet, but we're beginning to piece together the pieces. And one of the things is addressing why is it that there is so much discontent and poverty and disconnectedness of the people from their government and from all these governments from the global economy. And we're seeing that in programs such as the broader Middle East and North Africa Initiative and the MEPI, the Middle East Partnership Initiative. These are efforts on the U.S. in order to spur along domestic, internal reform on political, social, and economic and educational levels. I think that's part of the process. But the other part of the process has also got to be that you've got to counter the ideology by, A, discrediting it,
mm-hmm.
showing that it's not, this indeed is not mainstream Islamic beliefs, and B, presenting alternatives, not that by creating something yourself, but by giving greater voice to mainstream ideologies from the region. And we're not even doing that yet. We need to do that a whole lot better.
Well, I just want to remind listeners that we are speaking with Melissa Boyle-Maley. She is a former CIA operative. She worked in the office of the CIA's Office of Near East Operations and has recently published a new book called Denial and Deception, An Insider's View of the CIA from Iran-Contra to 9/11. I guess what I'm trying to get to in my own mind and trying to understand the current administration's policy in the Middle East and specifically Syria and Lebanon, which we'll get to in a bit, hopefully, if we have time, is to what extent do you think that a real shift has to be made from pursuing things in a realpolitik framework to looking at protecting the U.S. and Western countries, which, you know, get added to the target list, like the U.K., for instance? Is there a desire within the administration to make that shift from dealing in things, acting throughout the world, I guess, not just the Middle East, in terms of how do we best serve our interests and moving more in a direction of what are the best long-term solutions to these fundamental problems which do not go away if we don't address them? Do you think that interest is there?
I think that interest is there, but I don't think that the tools are there. This administration is very much playing the long game. And
the long game?
The long game.
Okay.
And that's with the democracy promotion game and of reforming the political reality of the Middle East. And so they're doing that. And at the same time, there is the global war on terrorism, which in many ways does undermine the larger vision, the long game. But I think the focus is on the long game. And as a consequence of that, there's a lot of issues that are what I call are the landmine issues that you're going to step on today or tomorrow that could potentially derail the entire process.
Like?
Like if you're trying to promote democracy in the Middle East and doing it through the tank, what's the implications for the whole concept of democracy?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this administration believes that that detail will be forgotten or overcome in the long term. the fact of the matter is that the Iraqis are voting and they're choosing their leadership and that they're beginning to shape their own future. So that's their perspective, and frankly, their perspective in their worldview, they see themselves as being successful.
So what do you say to at least the majority of people from the Middle East that I've spoken to, who argue along the lines of if democracy were the real aim, maybe it would be easier to start with your friends rather than your enemies? For example, try and get the Saudis or the Kuwaitis or the Egyptians to have more democratic societies, which wouldn't require an invasion, as opposed to going after Iraq, which would.
Yeah, you know, and I think that message, to a degree, a small degree, is being heard by the administration, because now you'll begin to see in the public discourse, as compared to like a year ago, calls on Saudi Arabia and calls on Egypt to reform. And not just economic reform, that's not sufficient, has to also be political reform, mm-hmm. and educational reform, which really touches the very heart of cultural issues. So we're beginning to see a more consistent approach, but it's certainly not completely consistent.
So I'm wondering how successful, you said that they have the administration has their eyes on the long game. How successful do you think that they can be with this two-pronged approach when, you know, we, meaning the US and the UK and other countries, for example, liberated Kuwait, so-called, in the first Gulf War, but we still haven't had the results of the Kuwaiti elections, which were promised over 15 years ago?
Yeah, that's a point that's very well taken, because there are so many inconsistencies in the region. But I would have to say Kuwait is not going to be able to slip by on its good graces. That, you know, you will hear the administration call for additional reforms within the Kuwaiti political establishment. But, you know, we talk around the margins. I mean, I think the really hard issues for the administration at this point in time are Libya and Israel.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to ask you about Israel next, because the whole Syria-Lebanon situation and Resolution 1559 is drawing the ire of a lot of Middle Easterners, and not the least of which the Syrians, of course, who complain that they're being pressured to implement a resolution when Israel currently stands in violation of over 70 of them, and they don't see any public pressure on Israel to implement resolutions. What's, again, I mean, it's sort of the same question. If you fail to address the core issue at the heart of the Middle East and push for democratization in other countries, do you think that people are actually going to buy that democracy is the aim?
Well, I think we are seeing democracy, and I think actually the people in the region want democracy.
I think they do.
Is very important, mm-hmm. and they don't want to get it at all costs. And I think that should be appreciated more by the U.S. administration. But, you know, frankly, two wrongs don't make a right. Syria has been not been implementing its own agreement, mm-hmm. with the Arab world, and I'm referring to the Taif Accords.
Right.
And plus, Syrian behavior on a variety of other issues have caused a lot of consternation with the U.S. Support for terrorism, support for the insurgents in Iraq. These issues have all raised serious profile and put them in the doghouse, so to speak, from the U.S. optic. Syria needs to get out of Lebanon. Needs to get out of Lebanon for distinctly local, I mean, regional issues.
And if they do, do you think that the administration will back off and leave them alone, or will the pressure continue for some other reason?
I think that that the pressure will continue, but I don't think it will continue in the same way. First of all, because there's not an international consensus on the issue beyond the Syrian withdrawal, total withdrawal from Lebanon. When you start talking about the other Syrian behaviors, certainly I don't think that we have either a consensus within the Arab League or with the European community, for that matter.
And I suppose it's easier to go after Syria in a political sense. You expend less political capital when you already are standing against the Syrians on so many issues than you would going after the Israelis, for example.
Well, I think the administration's policy on Israel is very mysterious in many ways. There's an awful lot of rhetoric, but not an awful lot of action. So it's hard to tell where the truth of the matter lies. But, you know, in my reading the tea leaves on this, I think the administration finally realizes it has to do something on the peace process front, that it cannot continue to ignore this. The Palestinians have stood up and demanded to have democracy, real democracy in their own territories, even while they're under occupation. And so, and their democratic experience has been very good, but it's fragile. And what is the U.S. going to say if they continue policies that systematically undermine the Palestinian democratic process? And by that, what I mean is if they do not empower Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, and his government by engaging or re-engaging in the peace process, I think that's critical. And in order to get Israel, Israel's not ready to sign up on the peace process right now. Mm-hmm. They'd like to stall for a variety of reasons, but I think it's the U.S.'s job to bring Israel back to the table.
Well, I think, as I predicted to you before we got on the air, we ran out of time, and I've got so many more questions still to ask you. I hope you will be able to join us again at some point in the future and discuss all of this.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
Thanks a lot for being with us. That was Melissa Boyle-Maley. She is a former CIA operative. She is the author of Denial and Deception, an insider's view of the CIA from Iran-Contra to 9/11. We didn't really get to talk about 9/11 a great deal, and I wanted to also ask a lot of questions about the CIA's role in Beirut in the mid-80s, which could be seen as the root of a lot of the things that are going on now between Syria and Lebanon. Issues for a future show. So we'll have to tune in on another Sunday between 6 and 7 and have another episode from Melissa, perhaps. She also may be joining me live with Saeed on Arab Voices at some point on a Wednesday night between 10 and 11. So we'll have to, I'll update you as we finalize that. We're going to take a very short break right now. And when we come back, we have Eric Eichenwald. Oh, excuse me, no, we don't. We have a feature piece from Shannon Young, former regular contributor to the show. You'll hear the intro to that from Pokey, and we'll be coming right back with that. Stay tuned.
On Tuesday, Florida Farm Worker Organization, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, announced an agreement with Taco Bell. The agreement ended a four-year-long boycott of the fast food giant. With more on the story, we go to report produced by Shannon Young.
The agreement reached this week between the Coalition of Immokalee Workers and Taco Bell marks the end of a boycott that had garnered the support of labor groups, students, and churches over the course of the past 4 years. In addition to cross-country speaking tours, the farm worker organization had also engaged in hunger strikes and embarked on long, multi-day marches to call attention to their list of demands. Member of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, Gerardo Reyes Chavez, speaking prior to the settlement.
We have three demands. One is a dialogue of three parts between Taco Bell, the growers that produce the tomato that Taco Bell use every day, and the representatives of the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. The next demand is 1 penny more per pound coming from Taco Bell under a contract that will increase the wages almost a double, because farm workers have received the same wages for over 20 years, and we are asking something to put this at the level of the inflation. The third demand will be a code of conduct that will ensure that no violations of human rights are happening in the fields where the tomatoes that Taco Bell is buying are being produced. And basically it will ensure that no slavery is happening in the fields.
Wages for Florida tomato pickers have been stagnant since the late 1970s. Farm workers are paid between 40 and 45 cents for each 32-pound bucket, which means that in order to make $50 in 1 day, a farm worker must pick 4,000 pounds of tomatoes. At a joint press conference on Tuesday, Taco Bell's Jonathan Blum tells of how the tomato pickers can expect an increase in their wages.
I'm pleased to inform you that Taco Bell has secured an agreement with several large tomato grower suppliers in Florida who employ the farm workers. These tomato suppliers have agreed to pass through the equivalent of 1 cent per pound directly to the workers. Taco Bell will be the first in our industry to directly help improve Florida tomato farm workers' wages. Taco Bell pledges to make this commitment real by buying only from Florida growers who pass this penny per pound payment entirely on to the farm workers. We will work with the CIW and our suppliers to monitor the pass-through for compliance.
This penny per pound will increase wages by approximately 80%. Coalition member Lucas Benitez explains via translator what this wage increase represents in economic terms.
There was a study done by the Department of Labor that reveals that on average, farm workers are earning $7,000 to $7,500 per year. In a good year, you might earn $8,000. So with this increase for the workers that would be working for the suppliers that Taco Bell buys from, it would mean almost reaching the poverty level.
This week's farm worker victory has as much history-making potential as the California grape pickers' struggle. Both causes received widespread support and used the consumer weapon of the boycott. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers, along with Cesar Chavez, on the importance of the boycott as a tool for change in the agricultural industry.
With the United Farm Workers, we took our struggle from Delano throughout the country, and we were able to get people to support our boycott. We were boycotting the stores and we asked people not to eat grapes, and it worked. And this is how we got all of our contracts. Without the boycott, it never would have happened.
According to statements made in the press conference announcing the settlement of the Taco Bell boycott, this agreement represents the first step in a new phase of the farm workers' struggle to effect change in the restaurant and supermarket industries that purchase the bulk of Florida's tomato crops. With additional audio from Austin Indie Media, this is Shannon Young reporting for KPFT's Sunday Monitor.
Okay, and we're back live in the studio, and we have with us Kurt Eichenwald. He's written for the New York Times for more than 17 years, is two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism, and a finalist for the 2000 Pulitzer Prize. His new book, Conspiracy of Fools, is just being released by Doubleday. Welcome to Sunday Monitor, Kurt.
Thanks for having me.
This is quite a large book you've got here. What was your goal now that we've seen, I guess, over a dozen books? And full disclosure here, I was a research assistant on one of the other books, Power Failure, by Mimi Schwartz with Sharon Watkins. So what did you hope to say that hadn't been said?
Well, my whole belief is that years ago, I began to notice that I would work on corporate fraud stories. That's all I do. I write about corporate fraud. And I'd write about a corrupt law firm. And then there would be a John Grisham book called The Firm. I'd write about a corrupt insurance company. And then there would be a John Grisham book called Rainmaker. And over time, I began to think, you know, every time there's a corporate scandal, John Grisham makes a book out of it. Finally, I saw him saying in a newspaper interview that, in fact, he got all his ideas from the newspapers. And I just figured I'm on the wrong side of this deal. And I realized that the stories that I was involved in, the stories that I wrote about, were much more interesting and much more thrilling than can actually be conveyed in a newspaper article, that in fact they made in and of themselves great thrillers. My ultimate desire when I'm writing the books is to write not something that tells people, here's everything you want to know about Enron. You may get that information, but ultimately it's to say, here is a corporate thriller. Here is a corporate thriller that in this case happens to be about Enron. Last one happened to be about the Archer Daniels Midland Company. And at the end of the day, give people a reading experience that is exciting, the kind of thing where they, you know, they'll read it on an airplane, they'll read it on the beach, hopefully. And but in the process, also learn about a real case.
Well, your previous book, as you mentioned, The Informant, is now being made into a movie.
Yes.
And you've got a lot of dialogue in this book, Conspiracy of Fools. Are you thinking movie for this book?
I know that there are a number of studios that are taking a look at it. I know that Steven Soderbergh is directing the movie version of The Informant, and that he is right now reading Conspiracy of Fools, and I just heard a day or so ago that he's loving it. So you know, whether or not something is a movie, that's not my decision nor something I am qualified to say, but I know it's being looked at.
Okay. One of my favorite quotes from the whole thing was an attorney, local attorney named Mike Ramsey, who is defending Ken Lay. And back in 2002, a reporter asked Ramsey how it was possible for the CEO of Enron to be so out of touch. Ramsey said it was a matter of the company's size and structure. Quote, "I don't think you understand the way Enron is set up," said Mike Ramsey. "I don't think you understand how many time zones it operates in." And he went on to talk about some other stuff. But and then later, interestingly enough, Donald Rumsfeld was talking about the torture at various prisons, including Abu Ghraib. And he said, this was like 2 years later, "If you're in Washington, D.C., you can't know what's going on in the midnight shift in one of many prisons around the world." So is the time zone defense, is that going to hold water?
Well, I think that's kind of a silly comment on Ramsey's part, because we're not talking about events that took place overseas. The question comes down to, and Lay is kind of stuck with a very difficult situation, in that there does seem to be this belief in the general population that if something happens at the corporation, obviously the chief executive knows about it. Well, the truth is, I've written about corporate fraud for 17 years, and the number of instances where the corporate fraud was directed from the top is very, very small. And more, the usual outcome is, in fact, that it's coming from the middle down. And I know that sort of runs antithetical to what everybody believes, but that's what's happened in the cases that have come to an end. So, you know, does that mean that Lay is innocent? No. Does that mean that him saying he didn't know is somehow ahistorical? No. You know, at the end of the day, we can't just say somebody is guilty because we believe they should be. We have to look at what it was that happened, what was their involvement, and that's really what this book does. It goes through and lays out everything that everybody did, what people knew, what they were told, and when. And, you know, I'm not real big on telling people, reach a conclusion, you know, this person's guilty, that person isn't. I'm saying, here are the facts. Read it and reach your own conclusions. There are people who have read it and concluded that everybody was guilty. There are people who've read it who've concluded that some people were and some people weren't. I find the reactions very interesting because they're all different. But no, the time zone defense is silly because, I mean, not only was it in the same time zone where a lot of the crimes were taking place, they were taking place on the same floor of the executive building.
Right here in downtown Houston.
Right in downtown Houston, right up on the 50th floor.
Right.
And so, you know, what you get down to, though, and one of the things I think this book underscores with a few exclamation points following it, is everyone seems to believe that Enron is only a crime story. And no doubt, crime plays a very large role in Enron. But it does not play the largest role. What plays the largest role in Enron, and the element that I've been shocked has been missed by so many people, is incompetence. The magnitude of the incompetence inside of Enron is unlike anything I've ever seen in any corporation I've written about. You've got a company, seventh largest company in America, that didn't track its cash, didn't know its cash position on any single day, didn't know when it owed money back, didn't know what guarantees it had made and to who, didn't know the terms of the requirements within the agreements to borrow money. And, you know, when you throw all that together and you go, this is supposed to be a major American corporation, and it's being run with less specificity and less discipline than some lemonade stands. And that was really, to me, the most shocking thing that came out of this book.
Well, there's a great scene there where the guy who's supposed to be making sure that the risk is overseen for all these incredibly complicated speculative financial instruments, and, you know, he's like trying to learn what a put is.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, and it's funny, all those scenes where you have the chief financial officer not understanding that what a hedge is, even though he's supposed to be putting hedges in place, when you have the chief risk officer not understanding some basic elements of risk, where you have the chief accounting officer making arguments that, you know, ultimately are ludicrous. And you put them all together and you say, what in the world happened to these people? And that's really what, you know, by giving this blow by blow within the book and letting the story unfold itself without me getting in the way, just having it be a narrative like a novel, people can really see how Enron really happened.
Well, there was also the Enron Energy Services, the retail division, with a desk full of checks that hadn't been cashed. So it was, what, $10 million or something like that?
Yeah.
But aside from incompetence, there were a number of institutions involved here that were supposed to be the watchdogs, and they seemed to be the lapdogs. Why don't you run down that whole domino theory of who didn't do what they were supposed to?
Oh, dear, that'll take the rest of the program.
Well, just one by one, in one sentence.
You have, let's start at the furthest out. You have the Wall Street analysts. Those were people who should have been looking much more closely at Enron's financial disclosures, didn't, and were pumping up the company, saying how wonderful it was. Now, there were some who were naysayers, but Enron got mad at them, threatened the banking fees of the firm, and those people were moved on. There were the investment bankers themselves who lapped up those fees. Enron threw out as many deals as they possibly could, and those guys were lapping up the fees and really not concerned about the overall corporation. There were the banks that were loaning the money to Enron, allowing it to do many of the things that really did not make a lot of financial sense. There was the primary accounting firm, Arthur Andersen. There were the law firms like Vinson and Elkins. At the end of the day, it wasn't that all of these people knew there was a problem, knew that things were bad, but just were keeping their eyes closed. What it was is that, you know, the late 1990s was an era of almost massive delusion, where we were celebrating businesses that had success that none of us could understand. And the naysayers, the ones who would say, wait a minute, you need earnings. Wait a minute, you need cash. Wait a minute, you need cost controls, were dismissed as old world thinkers who didn't comprehend the new economy. Anybody who was speaking reason was dismissed. And in that kind of environment, the lawyers and the bankers and the accountants and the rest, they raise their disputes with the irrational at their peril. And so in the end, they were the fools, but so were we. So were the investors who believed that we could become millionaires overnight, who believed that a company we didn't understand was going to be the answer to all of our problems. And, you know, Enron could never have happened in an environment of greater discipline, of accounting discipline, and of financial discipline.
Well, and you mean you didn't even name all of them, of course, the SEC, FERC, the board of directors.
It goes on and on.
You know,
and on
and on and on. And there were people inside Enron who were raising the call, and inside Arthur Andersen too, who nobody paid any attention to him, or they just transferred him out.
Well, and then at the end of the day, the one thing that always seems to happen in these is you look back at the people who are raising concerns, and it was, oh, and then everyone knew. And it's like, no, and then everyone dismissed what they said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a moment at which, it's a very, very small moment in the book, where the vice chairman of the company is listening to a presentation about Enron's effort to go into the water business. And he says, wait a minute, this is a lot of money to be spending on something we really don't understand very well, and I think we should focus our money on our energy businesses. And the response to that is, yeah, thank you, now move on and shut up. They don't say that, but that is the attitude he's treated with. And he was absolutely right. He was the smartest person in that room in terms of what should have been done. He was the only one speaking reasonably. But at the end of the day, that's why he was the one who was ignored, because the viewpoint of those who were celebrating Enron's greatness was, this is a man who just doesn't get it. Therefore, we really don't have to listen to him.
Well, Well, Enron, of course, will continue to be in the news. We have a report from Friday that Western Utilities won a battle in court, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has determined that Enron was engaging in illegal activity at the time it was entering into some contracts with these utilities. Do you want to tell people a little bit about that whole battle in Snohomish, or are you keeping in contact with all this stuff?
Yeah. Everything. I mean, basically, Snohomish is on the hook for a fair amount of money under a contract it entered into with Enron. They're arguing that when the contract was entered into, it was entered into under fraud, prices had been manipulated by the company, therefore they shouldn't be bound by the terms of the contract. And, you know, that to me, though, that's the kind of fine detail that belongs in the newspaper. You're not going to find that in the book. The book is really much more of the narrative arc of the primary characters. You know, here's where they are. Here's what they did. You'll see them in their, you know, in their boardrooms, in their bedrooms. You'll see them, you know, fighting and drunk and happy and miserable and, you know, in all of the reality. And I mean, it's not a pretty story. Nobody comes out of this looking good, but I think they come out of this looking much more real than you can get from a summary article in a newspaper.
Coming back to Ken Lay and his attorney, there was quite a PR offensive after it looked like Lay was going to be indicted, and indeed was. And Mike Ramsey did an op-ed in Houston Chronicle in November. In which he says that the only shares, being Enron shares, that Ken and Linda Lay ever sold during the months after Lay returned, after Skilling left, were to prevent margin calls.
Mm-hmm.
Quote, they never voluntarily sold a dime's worth after Ken's return. Lay's lost 95% of their wealth. What do you think of that argument?
It's true. I mean, he is making, on July 13th, I believe, Lay had a voluntary sales program, under which most corporate executives have, where they file to sell a certain amount every single day. And on July 13th of 2001, he canceled it. He said, I don't want to sell any more shares. From that point on, the only shares that he sold were those that were sold in response to margin calls. Now, Ramsey is incorrect saying he's trying to prevent margin calls. They're in response to margin calls. He already got them. That is what it is. I mean, the one thing that's interesting about those kinds of transactions is they create records, and I have all the records. And so I've seen, you know, when the margin calls hit, why they hit, what was done. So, in truth, you know, at the end of the day, that's why Lay isn't criminally charged, I believe, with insider trading. There's not a criminal charge on that with his sales of stock, because ultimately, it's very, very hard to make a criminal case that a forced sale is an insider trade. Now, he is charged with fraud for telling employees that he was buying shares when in the aggregate he was selling shares. I mean, the statement was true as far as it went. He had bought shares, but he was also selling far more than he had bought.
Well, he was paid about $300 million over 4 years. It's funny that he had to borrow money.
He wasn't paid about $300 million. What he had was, that was an exercise of stock options. The reason he borrowed money, I mean, this gets very complicated.
Well, actually, we are out of time, okay. Unfortunately, but we could parse it out. I think with one hand tied up behind my back, I could convict a guy of insider trading, but that's my opinion.
No, you couldn't, because he's not charged with it. So. He's not criminally.
Well, Kurt, it's great to have you on. Sorry we didn't get through all the book. Conspiracy of Fools by Kurt Eichenwald, just released by Doubleday. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Just before Kurt, you heard a piece that was produced and reported and presented by Shannon Young. And before her, you heard a live interview with Melissa Boyle-Maley. Her book is called Denial and Deception, an Insider's View of the CIA from Iran-Contra to 9/11. That does it for tonight's show. Thanks to Byron Jackson for production assistance, to my co-host, Pokey Anderson. This is Mark Grabowski saying thank you for listening, and join us again next week